Hello, everyone,
and welcome to the Conspiracy Hour. It's almost 49 years now since JFK was assassinated, shot and killed in Dallas, Texas. We were talking to Jim Mars about it. Jim's an expert on this JFK assassination, still working on it after all these years. And Jim brought up the fact that we still haven't solved that crime.
You'd think that the murder of the President of the United States at this time would have been thoroughly investigated and the truth would be known, but unfortunately that's not the case. John, and there's still nothing but controversy surrounding the murder of John F. Kennedy. What I find really interesting is that in the textbooks that were issued in the late 60s and 70s, they just flat stated that Kennedy was killed in Dallas by Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone assassin. And today, in the school textbooks, you don't read that anymore. Today, about the best they'll say is that Kennedy was shot while driving in a motorcade in Dallas and that his murder continues to be controversial.
This is Jerry Pippin. We're talking with Jim Mars. And since that book came out on the Kennedy assassination, have you changed any of your theory?
No, that's interesting. My book, Crossfire, which is a basis for the Oliver Stone movie, JFK, which caused such controversy in the early 90s, was actually published in the 80s. And that was based on information that I had years when I began teaching a course on the Kennedy assassination at the University of Texas at Arlington back in 1976. And at that time, the conclusion was, and my classes have all agreed to this after reviewing all the evidence, that number one, yes, there was a conspiracy. Number two, if Oswald even acted within that conspiracy, and that's a big if, he didn't really shoot anybody, and that the whole case has been covered up at the highest levels of the federal government of the United States, which is what elevates what at that time was simply a Texas homicide to a national coup d'etat.
We still get a lot of interest on this. I got an email from a fellow who was laying out a lot of evidence, and it's not anything new, but he wanted to get your reaction about it, and that was who was really behind it. He was trying to say it was the New Orleans connection with the CIA and Castro. Who do you think it was?
Well, first off, you know, the argument, one thing that's caused such controversy over the years is there's so many suspects. They say, was it the U.S. military? Was it the FBI? Was it the CIA? Was it the anti-Castro Cubans? Was it the mafia?
All of them.
Yeah, and the answer is yes, all of them. And the thing is, historically, it's well documented that under Operation Mongoose, which was the code word for the secret war against Castro, that you had the CIA, the military, the FBI, the anti-Castro Cubans, and the mafia, all working hand in glove in all kinds of plots, including assassination. So it doesn't take any stretch of the imagination to see that they simply sent their hit teams to Dallas.
In a moment, we'll be talking to Paris Flamand. He spent 2 years of his life down in New Orleans living and breathing with Jim Garrison, doing the investigation of the famed DA from New Orleans and the subject of that Oliver Stone movie, JFK. Flamand wanted to find out what made Garrison tick. What he found out was very interesting. Flamand has written Assassination of America, the Kennedy coup d'etat. It's the definitive story and an inside look at the Jim Garrison investigation. He delves into all of the JFK, RFK story and the assassinations and many details never before released by anyone else. It's available in several volumes. Before we talk with Paris, let's turn the hands of time back to November 29th, 1963. 1 week to the day after the murder of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas. In this recording, we hear Lyndon B. Johnson talking with J. Edgar Hoover, who was director of the FBI. Listen closely, and you'll find the description of what happened in Dallas. Discussion about Jack Ruby, the man who killed Lee Harvey Oswald in the Dallas jail. Oswald, of course, was accused of the assassination of Kennedy. Hoover reveals to Johnson that there actually was evidence that there were two Oswalds. He tells the president about Officer J.D. Trippett and how he was killed in the movie theater by Oswald shortly after the assassination. This is the actual recording, the actual phone conversation, as released by the LBJ Presidential Library.
This angle in Mexico is giving us a great deal of trouble because the stories they have, this man, Oswald, getting $6,500 from the Cuban embassy and then coming back to this country with it. We're not able to prove that fact. The information was that he was there on the 18th of September in Mexico City, and we are able to prove conclusively he was in New Orleans that day. Now, then they changed the date. The story came in changing the date to the 28th of September, and he was in Mexico City on the 28th. Now, the Mexican police have again arrested this woman, Duran, who's a member of the Cuban embassy, and will hold her for 2-3 more days. And we've got to confront her with the original informant who saw the money pass, so he says, and we're also going to put the lie detector test on him. Meantime, of course, Castro's hollering his head off.
Can you pay attention to those lie detector tests?
I would not pay 100% attention to them. All that they are is a psychological asset in an investigation. I wouldn't want to be a part to sending a man to the chair on a lie detector. For instance, we have found many cases where we've used them, and in a bank where there's been embezzlement, and a person will confess before the lie detector test is finished. They're more or less fearful of the fact that the lie detector test will show them guilty. Psychologically, they have that advantage because it's a misnomer to call it a lie detector, because what it really is, it's the evaluation of the chart that is made by this machine. And that evaluation is made by a human being. And any human being can be apt to make a wrong interpretation. So I would not myself go on that alone. If, on the other hand, if this fellow Oswald had lived and had taken me out of the lie detector test, and it had shown definitely that he had done these various things, together with the evidence that we very definitely have, it would have just added that much more strength to it. There's no question but that he is the man. Now, the fingerprints and things we have. This fellow, Rubenstein down there, he has offered to take the lie detector test, but his lawyer has got to be cross-consulted first, and I doubt whether the lawyer will allow him. He's one of these criminal lawyers from the West Coast, and somewhat like a Edward Bennett Williams type, and almost as much of a shyster.
Have you got any relationship between the two here?
Between Rubenstein?
Yeah.
No, at the present time, we have not. There was a story down there that...
Was he ever in his bar?
There was a story that this fellow had been in this nightclub, this strip tease joint that he has, but that has not been able to be confirmed. Now, this fellow Rubenstein is a very shady character, has a bad record, street brawler, fighter, that sort of thing. And in the place in Dallas, if a fellow came in there and couldn't pay his bill completely, Rubenstein would beat the very devil out of him and throw him out of the place. He was that kind of a fella. He didn't drink, didn't smoke, boasted about that. He's what I would put in the category, one of these egomaniacs. He likes to be in the limelight. He knew all the police in that white light district where the joints are in there. And he also let them come in, see the show, get food and get liquor and so forth. That's how I think he got into police headquarters. Because they accepted him as kind of a police character hanging around police headquarters. And for that reason raised no question. Because they never made any moves as the pictures show, even when they saw him approaching this fellow, and got up right to him and pressed his pistol against Oswald's stomach. Neither of the police officers on either side made any move to push him away or to grab him. It wasn't until after the gun was fired that they then moved. Now, of course, that is not the highest degree of efficiency, so to say. Secondly, the chief of police admits that he moved him in the morning as a convenience and at the request of the motion picture people who wanted to have daylight. He should have moved him at night, but he didn't. And, those derelictions in that phase But so far as tying Rubenstein and Oswald together, we haven't as yet done so. There have been a number of stories come in. We've tied Oswald into the Civil Liberties Union in New York, membership into that, and of course into this this Cuban Fair Play Commission committee, which was pro-Castro and dominated by communism and financed to some extent by the Castro government.
How many shots were fired?
Three.
Any of them fired at me?
No, there was another.
All three at the president?
All three at the president, and we have them. Two of the shots fired at the president were splintered, but they had characteristics on them so that our ballistic expert was able to prove that they were fired by this gun. The third shot, which hit the president, he was hit by the first and the third. The second shot hit the governor. The third shot is a complete bullet that wasn't shattered, and that rolled out of the president's head. It tore a large part of the president's head off, and in trying to massage his heart at the hospital, on the way to the hospital, they apparently loosened that, and that fell onto the stretcher, and we recovered that. And we have that, and we have the gun here also.
Were they aiming further?
They were aiming directly at the president. There's no question about that. This telescopic lens, which I've looked through, it brings a person as close to you as if they were sitting right beside you. And we also have tested the fact that you could fire, those three shots were fired within 3 seconds. There's been some stories going around in the papers and so forth that that must have been more than one man, but because no one man could fire those shots from the time that they were fired. We've just proved that by the actual test that we've made.
How did it happen? They hit Connally.
Connally turned to the president when the first shot was fired. And I think in that turning, it was where he got hit.
Yeah, in the turn, he probably wouldn't have got hit.
I think that's very likely.
When the president got hit second?
No, the president wasn't hit with the second one.
If Connally hadn't been in his way.
Oh, yes. The president no doubt would have been hit.
He'd been hit three times.
He'd been hit three times. On the fifth floor of that building where we found the gun and the wrapping paper in which the gun was wrapped, and upon which we find the full fingerprints of this man Oswald, on that floor we found the three empty shells that had been fired and one shell that had not been fired. In other words, there were four shells apparently, and he had fired three but didn't fire the fourth one. He then threw the gun aside and came down, and At the entrance of the building, he was stopped by a police officer, and some manager in the building told the police officer, "Well, he's all right. He works for you. You needn't hold him." So they let him go. That's how he got out. Mm-hmm. And then he got on a bus. The bus driver has identified him and went out to his home and got hold of a jacket that he wanted for some purpose and came back downtown, walking downtown. And the police officer who was killed stopped him, not knowing who he was and not knowing whether he was the man, but they were just on suspicion, and he fired, of course, and killed the police officer. Then he walked
about... You can prove that.
Oh, yes, we can prove that. Then he walked about another two blocks and went to the theater, and the woman at the theater window selling the tickets, she was so suspicious the way he was acting, and she said he was carrying a gun. He had a revolver at that time, with which he had killed the police officer. He went into the theater, and then she notified the police, and the police and our man down there went in there and located this particular man. We had quite a struggle with him. He fought like a regular lion, and he had to be subdued, of course, and his brother was then brought out, of course, taken to the police headquarters. But he apparently had come down the five flights of steps stairway from the fifth floor. So far as we found out, the elevator was not used, although he could have used it, but nobody remembers whether it was or whether it wasn't.
Well, your conclusion is A, he's the one that did it. B, the man he's after was the president. C, he would have hit him three times except the government turned.
I think that's correct.
Four, that there's no connection between he and Ruby that you can detect now. And five, whether he was connected with the Cuban operation with money you were trying to...
That's what we're trying to nail down now. Because he was strongly pro-Castro, he was strongly anti-American, and he had been in correspondence, which we have, with the Soviet embassy here in Washington, and with the American Civil Liberties Union, and with this Committee for Fair Play to Cuba. We have copies of the correspondence. So we've got him nailed down in his contact with them. None of those letters, however, dealt with any indication of violence or contemplated assassination. They were dealing with the matter of a visa for his wife to go back to Russia.
Well, I think J. Edgar Hoover laid out the official explanation of the Kennedy assassination, the one that, as time went by, people began to doubt and not really accept 100%, and now about 70-75% of the people think it's not even close to the truth, including many very good reporters. One of those good reporters is Paris Flamon. He spent some time with Jim Garrison. Jim Garrison was a DA down in New Orleans who felt that there was a conspiracy going on to kill John Kennedy. And Lee Harvey Oswald, who he knew, by the way, was not part of it. The Assassination of America, a series of in-depth books by Paris Flamon, a noted author and expert on JFK and RFK, and Jim Garrison.
I need only one to know only one thing, and he said, well, and he started to tell me about the investigation. I said, no, that's not what I have to know. No, what I have to know is, am I going to get the officers your complete cooperation on, in doing it? And he said, absolutely, absolutely. And he certainly gave it to me. And later on, he came up and visited me in New York a couple of times, and, you know, took him to the theater and restaurants and all that sort of thing. Very solidly, powerfully built. And he had great personal charm, had strange, very large eyes, very large blue eyes. As usual.
Coming up next on the Conspiracy Hour, an alternative theory, not Jim Garrison's, nor one you've probably heard. Stay tuned. You know, when we pause for a commercial, it's always for somebody who pays the freight, pays the way. Well, I'm going to take time out to talk about somebody who can't pay their way. And that's the stray animals, dogs and cats and other animals, who need your help. And there is a way to help them. Support no-kill animal shelters. It's a gift of life that keeps on giving. These animal shelters are located around the world and maybe in your neighborhood. Animals, they need love. They don't need to be sent someplace and then executed just because they don't have a home. Support the animal shelter that is a no-kill shelter near you. Give them a donation of $10, $25, $50 or more. The money will be well used. The animals will love you for it. So give a gift of love, a gift of life, to that stray dog or cat. Welcome back to the Conspiracy Hour. I am going to change the subject a little bit on JFK and present a theory, actually not me, but the author Ken Thomas, about JFK and the UFO connection. That's right, a UFO connection to the JFK assassination. And this seems to go all the way back to Maury Island up in Washington State. And a UFO incident. First of all, Guy Bannister, he had a connection up there as well. And this fellow you're talking about, Crispin, he has a connection there. And it's kind of strange. Kind of, if it's a coincidence, it's a pretty good one. Let's tell our audience about Maury Island again. A UFO was over the sound there, Puget Sound. It was wobbling, and it was having troubles, and some stuff spewed out and fell on a fishing boat. Have we seen, it was liquid, one was black and one was white or silver. Have we seen any pictures of this stuff?
There are photographs, yeah. No, the black stuff turned into rocks. I've seen photographs of that. The white stuff, I haven't. I don't know. I don't think there is a photographic record of that, just descriptions.
It was hot, and it killed a dog.
It killed a dog and wounds another guy.
Okay.
Doesn't kill it.
And Crispin kept some of the stuff and later ended up working for Boeing.
Yeah. It's the black substance, I believe, that was loaded up on the B-25. It's kind of sketchy what happens to the white stuff. Like a lot of it seems to just evaporate in the
mm-hmm. And the airplane, the Air Force plane, taking it back to Wright-Patterson for examination, crashed on takeoff or right afterwards.
Right.
Pretty strange story. And all this happened just before Roswell and 3 days before the Kenneth Arnold sighting.
Well, that's the point. The Air Force never, despite losing two men in a very expensive plane, there was never an official investigation. And Crisman and Dahl were never prosecuted for trying to pull off a hoax. You know, Crisman actually kind of disappears after that. But then, you know, while he's being investigated by Garrison, he becomes like a mini celebrity on the UFO circuit. And he makes the claim. Do you remember this old television show called The Invaders?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he claimed that was about him. You know, and this was about a guy who knew the secrets of the aliens, and that, you know, kind of hiding from the government, or nobody's believing him, and, you know, it's all a very kind of paranoid X-Files type show of its time. And Crisman made the claim to UFO people, Gary Leslie and Lucius Farish, that this was about him. And what makes that less far-fetched is that, remember, The Invaders was a Quinn Martin production. And Quinn Martin production also did the FBI.
Yes.
And when Mark Felt emerged as the guy who everybody now identifies as Deep Throat and Watergate, it was discovered that Mark Felt was a consultant on that old Efren Zimbalist Jr. show, the FBI. So the idea of people in the spook community being connected to these kinds of TV shows gets a little support, you know, and so maybe there was something to it.
Gee, even Mark Felt and Deep Throat's in this thing. It's interesting how these characters all came together. Let's get back to your thesis, your hypothesis here, is something that I really can latch on to, and that's this battle between General Dynamics and Boeing over not only the TFX fighter, but presumably for the next decade, all of this space business with NASA going to the moon and et cetera.
Right. You know, both of whom had things to lose if...
I wonder why JFK went with General Dynamics. Is there any evidence anywhere where he was, you know, taking some money or had a stock in it or something? Or I wonder what that deal was about.
It's an unsettled bit of business. The last person to ever do any writing about it was actually Seymour Hersh in a book called The Dark Side of Camelot. And he just has these passages describing how Kennedy was being spied upon by Boeing people. It supports all this, but he doesn't really go into the Crisman connection. The standard view, I mean, if you don't take the Warren Commission view that Oswald was a lone nut, the standard view that most people believe, that is more than 90% of the American public believe and understand that there was a conspiracy, and that most of those people believe that Kennedy was shot because he was pulling us out of Vietnam, which indeed he was. He signed an executive order reducing the number of advisors there. That was the beginning of a turnaround, you know, trying to power down and get away from Vietnam and get on to more important business here. And the week, of course, after he was assassinated, Johnson signs a countermanding order, stopping that, reversing that, and actually increasing advisor and troop strength in Vietnam.
Certainly there was some ideology here, but it all gets back to money, doesn't it? Huge sums of money we're talking about here, about waging a war, a race to the moon, new military equipment like the new fighter. Lots of money.
Yeah, it's a tremendous amount of money going after those defense contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And also things like Bell Helicopter. You know, if the Vietnam War ended, they're losing, you know, a huge contract to build the helicopters that were used in the fight to war. War is a big business.
So you're right. Money and war, they go together like a horse and carriage, as
yeah.
the song
says. Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. And what happened with the TFX is that eventually became the F-111, and the whole contract was actually sold to the Australians, which created this relationship, this funding corridor, that eventually led to the U.S. funding and helping to develop a facility known as Pine Gap in Australia. And Pine Gap is like the Area 51 of Australia. Yeah, these connections, and then there's this undercurrent of UFO connection, too. And when you get into the business about MJ-12, you know, the supposedly secret government group that was created after the Roswell crash. And Stan Friedman and other people have... Stan Friedman has done a particularly good job of tracking down the archives of the astronomer Don Menzel, who supposed to back channel to the MJ-12 group. And the thing is, there are lots and lots of documents floating around in the UFO world that pretend to be documents or say that, you know, this may be a hoax document, but in essence it's true and all this kind of thing. But in my research, there is one document that is impossible to have ever been faked and that establishes the existence of MJ-12. So there was such a group. Whether it was the primary mover in the Kennedy assassination, I don't know. It played a part, you know, probably. But, you know, there were so many reasons that JFK was rain that...
When we talk about MJ-12, do you think it still exists today? I mean, or was there a reason for it to go out of existence?
Well, it would be a reason to change its name now that it's so...
Yeah, right. Well,
and I'm sure that's happened. But... yeah, I mean, it better exist. I mean, the kind of money that we spend on armaments and spy satellites and surveillance software and Star Wars Defense Initiatives and all that other stuff, they better have a common sense interest that everybody else in this country has or should have about UFOs. You know, these mysteries out there that invade our airspace and, you know, potentially pose a threat to us all. So, I mean, yeah, they better exist for that reason, but, you know, if they actually did, you know, kill a head of state of ours, you know, that's a thing that needs to be known and redressed.
Seems to me that we've never really had a good investigation, if that's possible, of the JFK assassination. I mean, you know, there was the 1968
one. There was the, the 68, yeah, Garrison's investigation failed.
Yeah.
Obviously. But... they polled the jurors afterwards, and they said the weakest part of his case, the reason it failed, was that he could not prove this connection between Clay Shaw and the CIA. Many years later, a famous CIA defector, or a guy who quit the agency and wrote a book about it called The Cult of Intelligence, a guy named Victor Marchetti, said that he and demonstrated that Clay Shaw was indeed working for the CIA. And if Garrison had that when he was prosecuting, it's a possibility that would have gone over. There was another prosecution by Mark Lane against E. Howard Hunt, who was a Watergate burglar and also suspected of being one of the rail yard tramps. And Hunt had sued a newspaper for saying that, and Lane came in a defense, changing the defense from a no malice defense to one of truth, that he could prove that Hunt was there, and he won that case. So that's the closest thing there has ever been to a successful prosecution. But then there was the government investigation in the 70s, the House Assassinations Committee, that basically concluded that there was a conspiracy. So for many years, you had two conclusions from the government, you know, the Warren Commission lone nut thing and the House Assassinations Committee conclusion that it was a conspiracy probably of mobsters. Those conclusions were turned over to the Justice Department, and they just let it drop. But officially, even the government relented and said, yeah, there's a conspiracy here.
You know, Kim, one of the mysteries, or maybe it's not a mystery, the Kennedy family, they never seemed to push too hard on the real story behind the JFK and even the RFK assassinations.
Well, that's an interesting question. Well, you know, JFK was shot, RFK was killed, Ted Kennedy was set up at Chappaquiddick. They were coming after the Kennedy family, and everybody knew it. And Jackie Kennedy's response was to what? To marry Aristotle Onassis, the head of the international mob, so that she could get protection for the kids. And that went on for many years. And when she died, JFK Jr., Michael Kennedy, all the Kennedy kids started dropping off.
And why are they trying to kill all the Kennedys?
Because of the power that they represent, you know.
Well, I mean, even Caroline, you know, she started to run, then she dropped out. Maybe there's something going on there. A lot of people threatening a lot of people. Intimidation City. Let's get back to the JFK UFO connection. You think that's real?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very, very important. I think that's what the whole Chrisman story
and Fred Chrisman. What happened to
him?
He
died of natural causes in like the mid-70s, like 1975.
No deathbed confession.
And no deathbed confession. In fact, he spent his last years, well, his very last years, he was on the library committee in Tacoma. He tried to reform the city government, but also he was on the radio. He was a right-wing radio talk show host, one of the earliest. He was like the Rush Limbaugh of his day. And he had a business partner. This is a very interesting footnote to this. He had a business partner named Marshall Reconosciuto, whose son, Michael Reconosciuto, became the main informant to a guy named Danny Casolaro. My most known book is called The Octopus, Secret Government and the Death of Danny Casolaro.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this Danny guy.
And that's the connection. There's a direct connection from Chrisman to Casolaro. Casolaro exposed the Inflaw scandal, which was a scandal that was happening at the time of Iran-Contra that involved a super surveillance software called Prompt.
You're talking about the Reagan administration now, right? This involved the Reagan administration.
Reagan guys. The story there being that Reagan's team made connections with Khomeini to have the hostages, to hold on to the hostages until after Carter lost the election, the famous October surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And as a reward for that, one of Reagan's cronies...
Boy, was that an obvious thing, releasing them right when Reagan takes over the country, makes his inaugural address.
It was obvious.
The hostages are out of there. I mean, how obvious can you get? But that's the way they worked. In fact, that's the way they still work, this neocon movement.
I've heard people argue that the Zapruder film, for instance, was filmed so that they eventually could show it over and over again to people so they could, you know, people would get the idea, look, if we can do this to him, you know what we can do to you.
Kind of way the mafia works.
Yeah,
isn't it?
I mean, if you look at the assassinations, almost everybody who's assassinated is some mildly progressive Democrat, you know, JFK, RFK. There was a comedian actually named Bill Hicks who made a big joke about
it. Yeah, I know
Bill
Hicks.
Shot, he dies. RFK gets shot, he dies. Reagan gets shot, he survives.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what were they doing with Reagan there? Trying to give him a message, keep him straight?
Yeah, well, you hear stories that, you know, he didn't feel the bullet until he was inside the car. But, yeah, that is... You know, this gets into the George Bush, you know.
The Hinckley family, weren't they friends with Bush?
And George Bush was kind of really pulling the strings for many years as vice president to Reagan, as a CIA president, as the father of W. Bush.
Talking about George Bush Sr., we're really talking about a real, true life Dr. No. Somebody's been around to every major crisis, George Bush was there, even when Nixon had to resign. Guess what? George Bush took over the Republican National Committee chair.
That's the man. He also got debriefed on November 22nd, 1963. They surfaced the report. For a while there, they tried to say that there was another George Bush who got debriefed on the assassination, but they could never find that guy. So, yeah. So his tentacles go all over
then
the place.
Then, of course, the Golden Triangle, the CIA.
At one time.
And the
CIA.
And the drug running to get money off budget.
Right. And his father, Prescott Bush, was actually censured by Congress for all of his connections.
For being a Nazi.
The Nazi business.
And, of course, I don't know if you know the story or not, but I understand it's true that Roosevelt said, hey, we can't prosecute Prescott Bush. And the reason he said that was because Prescott Bush had done something very clever. He had just started the USO. You know, the United Service Organization for Servicemen during World War II. You going to prosecute that guy for being a Nazi?
There's a Nazi connection. There's all that Nazi connection. You know, there's the Bush Nazi family interest, the Clay Shaw and Wernher von Braun, the integration of Reinhard Gehlen network into the CIA, the Nazi intelligence network.
Now we get back to the UFO question and murder. Why are people in the United States government, if that's who's doing it, why are they killing people over UFO secrets?
Yeah, it's interesting. And most of these kind of high-tech operations and space operations have some degree of death associated with them. You remember at one time there was a series of scientists that worked for SDI, the Star Wars Initiative, that all died mysterious deaths. Recently, forget the man's name, but there was one of the scientists that was connected to the project that just discovered water on the moon, has been set up by the FBI, who posed as Israeli agents and trapped him, and now he's under arrest.
So what do you think's going on there?
In every one of these cases, it's hard to know, but high
I guess it has something to do with money and power.
Yeah, it involves money and it involves knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you know too much, you know, they got to keep you under control.
Ken Thomas here on the Conspiracy Hour. We'll be back in a moment with more on JFK. I'd like to take an opportunity here to talk to you about our websites. We've been adding programs and adding programs, and sometimes it's difficult to find what you're looking for. First of all, we have a search mechanism on each of our websites, and you can click, like if it's jerrypippin.com or ipodshows.net, just search the websites, put in the name of what you're looking for, and it will come up. Check us out, won't you? Often. We're talking with Ken Thomas, a researcher and author who does some pretty good investigating, in fact, some very good investigating pieces on different conspiracies. You know, Ken, I'm not even sure it's the government itself. I mean, purely the government. It seems to me that these corporations, they got a lot to lose, and they'd be involved, and they probably would be pretty vicious.
Well, that really was the lesson of the octopus, the idea of the octopus, that there are these transnational corporate presences who all have kind of interlocking police agencies working for them. Without getting into too much detail, this involves Wackenhut, but also the CIA, the Mossad, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. All of these people illegally bought this promise software. That's the chunk of the story that I left out. This O'Brien guy was given this promise software, which was a surveillance software, to sell around the world illegally because it didn't belong to him. That was his payoff for making the drop to Khomeini, for the money that was gave to Khomeini to hold on to the hostages. So, yeah, when you say the government, what government are you talking about? You know, the elected government, the political government that we have, that we go through these election cycles every 4 or 8 years to put people in there, supposedly that are supported by, you know, some large group of citizens, or is it the parapolitical government, you know, the ones that have corporate executives who are put there because they've been able to meet their ambitions up with, the right people and able to pull strings and make sure certain governments topple, certain people die, that kind of thing.
What book are you working on now?
Well, the book that I have out now is called Secret and Suppressed 2, Banned Ideas and Hidden History into the 21st Century. And that is, it's a collection of different conspiracy articles, different people. My contribution to it actually goes a little further into the roots of the military-industrial complex. Mine is about Wilhelm Reich and his connection to Dwight Eisenhower and Eisenhower and all the stories about Eisenhower meeting with aliens and how this is all part of
this. This Eisenhower and E.T. meeting thing, I mean, there's lots of stories out there. We've done lots of shows on it, have lots of documentation. Seems to me that something might have happened, maybe at Edwards. No, Ken, there seems to be a lot of evidence that in the 1950s we had had some sort of little war going on with these UFOs.
Yeah, well, that's the idea.
Why?
The aliens were kind of attracted to the atomic testing. In the desert, you know, that the whole war ended.
Yeah, and there's a lot of evidence that some of these high-powered radars that people suspect caused some of these UFO crashes back there in New Mexico.
Yeah.
Actually, they were done on purpose.
Yeah.
Have you heard about that? Have you heard that?
No, I have. I know that sometimes some researchers refer to the Maury Island incident and the Bannister UFO as radar fogging devices of some sort. But yeah,
let's get back to your situation, the Maury Island UFO incident.
No, it's lost. It's kind of lost to history. I mean, Arnold talks about it in Coming of the Saucers. He says the stuff looked a lot like, you know, regular.
Do you have any idea what that stuff was dripping from the saucer, the black and the white stuff, the silver stuff?
But it was liquid originally.
Well, the white stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have a wobbling flying saucer, and what happens in the incident is that it's wobbling, and that's why all that crap is coming off of it. Then one of the other circling saucers touches it, and it straightens up, and then they all fly away. One researcher suggested to me, in fact, that those saucers 3 days later, maybe that's what Kenneth Arnold saw in that formation. And then the following month, maybe that wobbling flying saucer wasn't repaired as well as they thought it was, and it crashed in Roswell. This is the unified saucer theory of what was going on in 47.
You know, the naysayers to extraterrestrial life coming here, they say this was a Nazi thing, the thing we'd recovered from the Nazis.
Well, yeah, the Nazis were developing saucer-shaped craft at the end of the war.
Well, I'm kind of leaning toward the extraterrestrial theory myself. But,
yeah, well, I know people, John Judge particularly, who's a famous JFK researcher, just will have none of the UFO extraterrestrial stuff. He says it's all Nazis. Yeah, yeah.
So Fred Crispin goes to work for Boeing. There's a Boeing General Dynamics battle over the race to the moon with Kennedy, and it all came forward on the development of that fighter. Do you subscribe to the idea that there's a lot of technology out there, black operations that are way beyond our wildest dreams?
Oh, I'm certain of that. You got to hope, you know, you got to hope that the Pentagon...
But I wonder why they keep it secret now.
Well, they parcel that. I have news clippings in my files here that show that, you know, they developed the hydrogen fuel cell in 1947, too.
Technically speaking, 1947 was a very good year.
Yeah, well, the thing is, the idea is that this stuff is hard to decode, you know, that we've recovered some things and we're trying to understand it. One of the interesting things about the MJ-12 business is that one of the members of MJ-12 is a guy named Vannevar Bush, who was a scientific advisor.
Yeah, I've heard that name many times.
Yeah, well, he's known well amongst the computer people for an essay he wrote called As We May Think, in which he, and it was written right at the time of the Roswell assassination, and before there are any computers, and he's writing about kind of like a Rube Goldberg desk that has microfilm and microfiche, and saying that, you know, pointing out that the sum of human knowledge has gotten to be so much and so complex that we have to create this kind of new technology that we can manage it better. He's basically describing personal computers that eventually, you know, we all start to use after a while. So, you know, there's even the thought that the PCs that we use is back-engineered Roswell technology from aliens.
I go along with that pretty much about Roswell. In fact, I think, you know, we turned over so much stuff to corporations to back-engineer and develop and et cetera, and they got patents and... just a lot of business interests tied up in this now, more than really the government's interest. Of course, they're kind of the same. A good corporate lawyer would advise, don't disclose. I mean, some guy's going to get together a bunch of people and file a class action suit, and you never know, some of these liberal judges, they'll have to give our profits away to the government. I mean, that would pay for health care alone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we live in an environment where it's only part secret. I mean, anybody who pays attention to it realizes that there's something real going on here.
Yeah.
So it's kind of out in public, but, you know, if you try to push in any kind of, you know, serious, solid legal direction, it vanishes and it disappears, or it gets difficult for anybody to claim responsibility for it.
That was Ken Thomas. Since we mentioned UFOs in this show, I thought we'd close our conspiracy hour this week with a UFO conspiracy. Efforts to keep quiet that we're actually being visited by visitors from other worlds. So listen to this. The Cisco Grove encounter. It happened in September of 1964. Donald Schramm was hunting in the mountains near Cisco Grove in California, located near the Nevada border. Schramm was hunting with a bow and arrow. It was before the gun season opened. He had two buddies with him. Both of them, as well as Schramm, worked at the Aerojet Corporation in Sacramento. As it got dark, Schramm was separated from the other two. And early in the evening, he saw a strange light that turned out to be a spaceship. It was a large one, estimated between 140 and 150 feet wide. It had three doors. They slid open. Here is how Schramm explains why he was where he was when this event happened.
Well, we were getting ready for the evening hunt, And I was went down the one ridge, and this one friend of mine went down the canyon bottom, and the other went down the other ridge. And when we got to the end of the ridge, it was just a sheer drop-off where I was, so I had to backtrack and go down and around the other side of the ridge. And by the time I got to the bottom, it was pitch black. And so I stumbled through the brush. I couldn't see nothing. It was just dark. It, you know, before the moon comes up, it gets really dark in the mountains. And I like I said, I crashed through the brush and stuff, and then I could see the moon was starting up, and I saw the big granite cliff with a crack that went up the side, and the crack was about a foot wide, so I was able to walk up there, and there was a tree right at the edge when I got up there. So I figured there's a lot of bear in the area, so I figured I'd spend the night in the tree. The base of the tree to the first limb was about 12 feet, but from the rock, it was only about 7 feet. I could reach up and hand walk out to the trunk of the tree and then pull myself up. Anyway, there was two limbs come out on an angle, and then there was one that I sit on, and then I put my foot on the other one. And so I was figuring on spending the night up there, and then I saw a light. It looked like a lantern going up and down a trail, but then it came over the top of the tree. And I got kind of excited then because I thought it was a helicopter from the Forest Service. I stood between two of the fires that I built on the rocks and waved my arms and yelled and screamed. And finally, that light started coming towards me. So I was really relieved then because I thought it was a helicopter still until it got within, maybe 60 feet or yards. I'm not sure the distance at night. But it just stood, hovered there with no sound. So then I panicked because I knew it was no helicopter. And then I saw three panels of light, like windows or whatever. And I saw a flash come from the bottom of the center one, and just saw a dark object go down to in the canyon, and then I lost track of it. And then the next thing I saw was a little blinking light up on the top of originally where the first one came from, but then I saw, when it landed up on the ridge, that it I could see like a half. I could only see part of the top, but it had a little light on it, and looked like the top of a flying saucer that I'd seen in pictures.
Schwamm saw three figures come out. Two were humanoid, and one was robotic. Looked like something out of a movie.
No, it was just a kind of a dark shadow. I could see the two like eyes that were looked like welding goggles to me. They were the same as welding goggles, and then the rest of the face was kind of a blur. I couldn't see looking down at him. Come down up on the rock. He was about 7 feet from me, and then he touched his mouth, and kind of a steam vapor came out of his mouth, and it lit up his face so I could see some detail. And then I blacked out when that steam hit me, or I guess it was. It was kind of took the air from me. And I'd gasp for air and then black out. And I fell over my boat. And that's the only thing that kept me in the tree. And then, so I figured they were out to get me then.
Donald Schrum managed to evade them all night by climbing up to the top of the tree. And he passed out. He had a belt around the tree. He woke up in the morning. They were gone. An encounter that he never talked about for years. He worked for a defense contractor in Sacramento. That's our show for tonight. Thanks for listening. I'm Jerry Piven.